I don't want a pickle. I just want to ride on my motorcycle.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Snokomoto Podcast, episode number 237. And it's a historic, historic episode. Do you know why?
I do not.
Well, first I'm going to introduce this. I'm your host, MotoGP, and with me is your other host, Swiggy.
Yep.
And we are coming to you from from the Moto One Podcast Network Studios Recording Suite A, which is important. It has to do with why this is such a historic episode. So, if you hear any banging or clanking in the background, there's a hazmat, like, you know, cleanup crew next door in the president's office, because there's a shit smeared ticket on his desk that needs removed and the whole area has to be sanitized, because I had to wipe my ass with a ticket that he asked one of the fucking parking rent-a-cops to write up and put on my bike. So in between last episode and this episode, historic legislation has been signed. What was that legislation, Swigs?
Yeah, Colorado got a lane splitting bill.
Hallelujah! So, I, as often as I do, Moto One Podcast Network Studios, guys, it's fucking huge, right? There's often like a quarter mile of two lanes of traffic trying to get in to the guard shack, and there's like a lot of security, whatever. So I frequently just split in the traffic and go straight to the guard shack, right? Well, wouldn't you know it, the president of the Moto One Podcast Network Studios is one of these guys that thinks lane splitting's way too fucking dangerous and it's not a good and legal thing to do. So he asked one of the fucking rent-a-cops to put a ticket on my bike. So I was forced to wipe my ass with it and put it on his fucking desk. And I may have pissed on his keyboard too. Allegedly. Anyway, so I am so stoked about this. I know most of the details, but Swigs, let's bring everyone up to speed on the details of this lane splitting law, because lane splitting, you know, you'd think it'd be as simple as a simple on-off operation, but it's not. Every lane splitting law has to be fucking different. It's like lane splitting laws are non-conformist teenagers that just have to do something a little extra fucking weird. Okay, so like what's the black fingernail polish of this specific law?
So for this law, it's pretty straightforward, and it's very similar to the Utah law that got passed a few years ago. Essentially, you can lane split only through stopped traffic. It doesn't explicitly say this, but it basically eliminates all the other options. You can split between two lanes of traffic going in the same direction, not more than 15 miles an hour while they're stopped. And you can't do things like use the shoulder or, you can't use a hard shoulder. And on something like a highway, you're not allowed to like go between like a barrier or the wall and a line of traffic.
Right. I agree with this. In a lot of places in Europe, you are allowed to filter on the outside, and I don't know how I feel about that. I think it's just for single lane traffic, maybe. I don't know the specifics. But there are situations where you can filter on the outside. I agree with this being a two lane only situation, at least for now. I don't think you should be able to use the shoulder. The shoulder is there for a reason. It needs to be an escape route, not just for bikes, but for cars. Should an emergency arise, it needs to be there for broken down vehicles. It needs to be there for emergency services. It needs to be there for a whole bunch of things. I don't even like these situations where we have adaptive lanes. So in Rush Hour, the shoulder disappears. I think in Rush Hour, the shoulder is more important than ever.
But yeah.
Why would you take the shoulder away when, like, for the primary reason it's there? It's ridiculous. So I agree, bikes should not be
able
to...
It would be literally impossible for an ambulance to get more than a mile in any direction in under 20 minutes if they took the shoulder... Or they turn the shoulder into a lane during rush hour. Like, ambulances would not be able to traverse the city.
Right. And I it's just reasonable that there should be a free and open lane for any number of things. Like I said, if there's a crash and the two cars are able to pull over onto the shoulder, if...
Or when a crash happens, for the fucking tow truck to get there to clear the accident.
All kinds of things. Exactly. So the less that we let people use the shoulder for willy-nilly, the better. You know? Like, what if you're driving and, like, an improperly connected trailer comes loose and they need to pull over somewhere, right? The shoulder just needs to be a place where you can reasonably expect a motorist that's in a sudden situation to just be able to pull into without checking. You know? You just have reason to get into the shoulder immediately. Right? So there shouldn't be filtering bikes and nonsense there. So I agree with that. But I've already talked to several people, motorcyclists included, whose opinion is, oh no, this shouldn't be happening. And the people who signed the bill stated that the biggest obstacle is going to be public perception. Basically, they said, we know the science behind this. It's for safety. It's going to increase safety. But is the public going to accept it? That's really the problem that they're facing. Because this bill is not permanent. The ability to lane split will automatically end after a 3-year trial period. And then they'll reevaluate if they want the law to continue or not.
Yeah.
So they're already anticipating tons of pushback because people have been educated incorrectly on this subject. I've seen so many posts on forums and things where people are like, well, the average semi truck is 9 feet wide and a lane is 10 feet wide. So there's just not enough room. Well, there's nothing that says you have to pass in between two semi trucks on the highway.
And it's generally not advised.
It's generally not advised. Yeah. You could just sort of hover in your traffic position for a minute until those two semi trucks aren't right next to each other. Because
but also you can only pass them when they're stopped anyway. So it's not even, and you know, semi trucks don't just leap out at you. Like,
yeah.
I'm pretty sure you can traverse the length of a semi truck in the amount of time it takes it to get rolling more than 5 miles an hour. So what do you think's actually going to happen here? Like, I don't know.
Yeah, the situation in which you would pass two semi-trucks in between at speed is, one, so rare, but two, why would someone even do it?
Well, this is similar to somebody, like, I think this is just, like, similar commentary from somebody who hasn't, like, gone into, like, heavy scooter traffic and think, this seems crazy, this is insane, how could anyone possibly navigate this, this is so dangerous. But if you've actually done it, like... It's not that hard. It's not that dangerous. It's not that bad. I think there's just I think it's purely from a complete lack of experience and then just kind of a gut reaction. And I think once people do it, once people start doing it regularly and it's legal, I think it'll normalize fairly quickly.
I certainly hope so. Everybody, not everybody, but the vast majority of Americans have... frankly, a wrong opinion about this because their opinion is informed by being a car driver first. And you might say, well, fuck you. I learned to drive a car, but like I ride a motorcycle most everywhere I go. Sure. But you learned to drive a car first. And so did I. But I spent a lot of time looking into this subject, which not a lot of people do. They're like, it's illegal. There's no reason for me to look into it, right? It's illegal. I've heard that it's wrong. Case closed. Ugh, that fucking cleanup crew next door. Hey, shut up. So, where was I? Right. So, check it out. It is a good, safe, and legal thing to do. Look it up. The only way in which it might be more dangerous is if someone is going a ridiculously high rate of speed in between slow-moving traffic, which people just don't do because, like, it's a terrifying thing to do. Like, could someone do it? Yeah, but, like, people also do all kinds of dumb things, right? The rate at which people will do dumb things does not increase because this is legal. It might emotionally to you feel like that's going to happen, but that's just not how people and the world works. People who do dumb things are just people who do dumb things. And there being a law about doing something or not doing something doesn't really deter people from doing or not doing that dumb thing. It just puts consequences there. But consequences really aren't much of a deterrent to people doing dumb things. And if you don't agree with that, I can't help you, right? But what I can say is that there's tons of data out there to suggest that there are less low-speed accidents and rear-end accidents with motorcycles if they're allowed to lane split, and it helps traffic jams a few percent. These seem like huge upsides for a piece of paper. No infrastructure has to be built. No one needs to be coached up on anything, except that this is a thing that is okay to do now. I guarantee you, more motorists will be hurt by car drivers seeing a motorcycle doing this, getting incensed and trying to push a wheel out onto the line to try to, like, cut off a motorcycle doing this than anything else. That will 100-fold be the biggest problem with this. Just non-compliance from car drivers.
Yeah. If there's somebody you want to get incensed at, it should be the person driving through Lodo or Rhino in a fucking Escalade.
Right.
In an area where there is not enough road infrastructure to handle the traffic, and somebody decided to bring a fucking behemoth into downtown. That is the person you should be incensed at, not the person on a motorcycle or a scooter who can park on the curb.
I wouldn't say Escalade, though. I would just say F-150. Have you seen an Escalade lately? They're not as big as you remember. The biggest thing on the road now are Ford F-150, 250, 350, and Dodge Ram trucks. They are bigger than Escalades. They're so comically large and tall. And it seems odd, but I saw like a 90s Escalade next to an F-150 the other day. And I was like, huh. That one there used to be the biggest thing by far, and now that's the bigger thing. Huh. Like, I knew it intellectually, but to see it in front of me?
That might be a good discussion to have another day about CAFE standards and the size of vehicles and why that happened, and also why nobody makes a good light truck anymore, to the point that people are asking me if they can buy my 20-year-old
Ranger. You go, people try to buy the Ranger. Yeah,
but that's a good discussion for another time.
So for the motorcyclists out there that are nervous about trying, I mean, because I will be like, the day it's legal, August 7th, I will be out on my motorcycle or scooter trying to find traffic situations where I can lane split, right? This is like for me, like when I turned 18, right? And I was like, we're going to the store, guys. I'm buying cigarettes. I'm buying porn. I'm buying a lottery ticket. Like everything I'm allowed to buy today now, I'm going to exercise this right. I will be doing that in like, and I'll do it in Greeley. I'll do it in Loveland. I'll do it in Denver. I'll do it in Fort Collins. I might go to Cheyenne and be like, hey, it's legal 20 miles over there. I'm just going to do it here. Right? Like, I will be doing it fucking everywhere on that. I'm just going to have a lane splitting day.
Just go out for the sole purpose of finding opportunities to lane split.
I'll pass people on the center line when there's not a car on the other side rather than go into the other lane completely. I'll just go on the line and I'll ride down the center of the road between two imaginary cars. I don't give a shit. I'm not going to do that, but I'm going to be excited about it. And I know I'm going to have to make a gigantic sign that says it's legal, deal with it, and like hold it on my, I'm going to have to go like ride with a giant sandwich board on myself. Right. But for riders who have never done this and who are nervous about doing this, I think we should talk about a few of the techniques that you need to keep in mind to do this like the first time, right? Mm-hmm. So number one, it's not like you're going to be expected to do this just because it's possible. If you want to not lane split, you can just sit in traffic like an idiot. That's totally fine and acceptable. And I did that on one day when Claire and I were in California this summer because she didn't feel comfortable lane splitting. So I was like, I'll just sit here with you. It's fine. I mean, people think we're weird right now because we're not lane splitting, but like, it's fine. I don't care what the drivers think. Right. So that, number one, that's an option. So there's no reason to feel nervous about this. It's like, okay, cigarettes are legal. No one's putting a gun to your head to smoke. Right. No one's
right.
It's like, it's fine. Like, I mean, lane splitting is a lot safer than cigarettes, but whatever. Second, this, as the law outlines it, this is something that happens below 15 miles an hour. Traffic has to be doing less than 15, and you can go a maximum of 15. So,
no, it says traffic has to be stopped.
Oh, does it? Oh, I didn't. I thought it was because the Utah thing said it was like lower than 15 and your max is 15. Maybe I get confused. Anyway, yeah. So if it's a full on traffic jam, you're just allowed to, as slowly as you like, go up the middle. You can walk your bike up the middle in between the two cars.
Yeah.
Like, completely. You can walk. You could get off the bike and just push it between the cars. So.
Yeah. And the question there is, like, when you actually, I mean, I think most people in car, I mean, most people will understand this because I assume you probably ride a motorcycle if you listen to this podcast. But most people in cars, like, see the gap.
I don't know, they might ride Can-Ams.
That's true. Also, the law specifies two-wheeled vehicles, by the way. So, oh, yeah. Even if there was a gap, Can-Ams aren't invited to the party. So,
excellent. now, if you ride a Can-Am, you're fine. But,
So, most people in cars, like, see the gap between a lane, and they don't see a gap because their brain has been, you know, you're conditioned into this kind of discrete world in which there's a lane here, there's a lane here, and they meet up in the middle, and there's no gap. But, you know, if you ride a motorcycle and you're out and you're stopped in traffic, if you just take a look around, there's a fuck ton of space. Lanes are much wider than people actually think. And
way wider.
And there's so much more space than you think. And, yeah, you can just, in most, like, relatively small roads in the U.S., like, you can pass a Harley-Davidson through with, like, 2 feet on either side of your handlebars to get through.
Just real quick, look up the handlebar width on a Harley Davidson Road King. I'm just trying to think, like, what model probably has the widest handlebars? I would guess, like, all the big frame Harleys probably have something very similar on them. I mean, I think, you know, the Road King's got to be about as wide as it gets. Because the widest part of the bike is the handlebars. By several inches, usually.
First result I see says about 32 inches.
Okay. So 2.5 feet. 2.5 feet when there might be... Seriously, there might be as much as 6 feet in between two cars.
Yeah.
Like, I know, like, sure, a semi-truck is 9 feet or whatever, but you'd be amazed how narrow your car probably is. Your car is probably, like, 5.5 to 6 feet wide.
A lot of cars are about 6 feet, usually, yeah.
Yeah.
Or like a big car will be 6 feet.
Yeah. You might be trying to only put 36 inches, 2.5 feet, in a 6 foot gap. At least a 5 foot gap. Like, you have like a 25% margin of error on either side of you.
Yeah. Like, you know, the balance beam at the Olympics would not be nearly as impressive if it was like 4 feet wide. But that's kind of what you're working with,
right,
when it comes to keeping a motorcycle between the cars.
Now, so the question is with a gap of somewhere between 1 to 2.5 feet on either side of you, do you think you could manage that at parking lot speeds? Because I do. Because that's what we're talking about. Yeah, because if you can't handle it at parking lot speeds, it's honestly time to go take the MSF course again. Because part of the MSF course is at very slow speed. As slow as you can, like, you know, less than 10 miles an hour, being able to keep your tire within a 6-inch. Or, no, sorry, 1 foot, 1 foot thing. It might be 10 inches or whatever it is, whatever the slow race that they make you do.
Yeah.
Like, this is something we expect people on their first and second day ever riding a motorcycle to be able to do. Like, it's straight up on the basic rider course, the ability to do this. So, do you think you're a rider who could pass the basic rider course? Because if the answer is yes, you should be able to do this extremely reliably and safely. As reliably as you can do anything else on your motorcycle. And oddly, maintaining that straight line, if you go out into a parking lot and practice it, is easier at speed. Like, at the full 15 miles an hour, you'd be amazed how much easier it is than like 4 miles an hour.
I mean, you really shouldn't run into any difficulty until you're under 2 miles an hour. Like, at that point, you've got enough gyroscopic forces working in your favor that it's not hard.
Right. So the point is you can take it as slow as you like. It can be walking pace because you're next to stopped traffic. It's that simple. And then when traffic starts moving again, there's a gap, and you just get back in line with the cars. But, like, you know, you're always kind of on slightly one side or the other. So you'll notice that you don't even actually have to try to merge back into traffic. When traffic starts moving again,
you're already faster.
The car distance just opens up, and the cars just automatically give you space, and you just go into it. Like, it's not a thing that you even really have to consciously enter and exit. You think about there being this, like, sacred lane space in between cars that you're not supposed to touch. But it's just this big open space that you're allowed to be in. A couple other things that do make it easier, though. I mean, like I said, you're probably just without any training going to be able to just do this. But there are two things that you can do that will instantly boost your confidence. Number one, look way down the row of cars. Don't look at the cars right in front of you, or even worse, the ground right in front of you. Don't do that. Look way down the row of cars. And really the big thing you're looking for is if someone is parked, so like in the stop traffic so you can't get past them, well, then you're just naturally going to come there and stop. Because there's no legal requirement that you have to be moving as well. You're just you just stop until they move, and then you continue on your way. It's that simple. People think, well, what if there's a gap that I can't get through? Well, then you're not going to go through it. It's that simple. At which point, you're also going to be entitled to honk your horn and be like, hey, dude, could you move over? It's that simple. Second, put your toes on the pegs, not your heels, not the arch of your foot, the balls of your feet. I know you're used to just riding around super fast, but if you have to do something slow, you know when you don't need to change gears? When you're doing under 15 miles an hour. You might have your right foot forward a little bit to be manipulating the rear brake, but in general, put your toes on your pegs. Just try this. Next time you're out on your bike in a parking lot, ride around with your toes on the pegs, and you'll be amazed how much slower you can go. Honestly, if you have your toes on the pegs, usually you can actually hold your motorcycle upright way longer than you think at a complete stop. If you're on level ground, you'd be amazed. Like, watch videos of people doing it on a bicycle. And you're like, that's not the same thing. It's way more the same thing than you think it is. And if you don't believe me, come to my house and I'll sit on my fucking Goldwing with my toes on the pegs and I'll fucking show you me hold that bike up at a standstill. So there you go. You're not going to fall over because you're going slow and dent the car next to you. You're not going to crash into a stopped car, and you're going to look down the road so you can see that coming like 30 seconds before you would get to it. And if you're doing under 15 miles an hour and you're looking, let's say, only 5 cars ahead of you, I would like to think that at 12 to 15 miles an hour, you can stop in the length of 2 cars. Like, with the worst reaction time and the worst braking technique, you'll still be able to do that, even though you should be able to stop in, like, 9 feet or something. So there we go. I don't know, Swigs. Like, what else do you recommend to people for the technique of lane splitting?
Well, this is mostly applies to people on sport bikes, but something they should have done ages ago anyway. Something that will help you a lot is not leaning on your handlebars.
This is one of those things that just putting your toes on the pegs automatically helps. It's weird to think about it, but it forces a lot of your body position and posture to be corrected. Mm-hmm. It's really hard to actually put your toes like further back like that, like to get your toes underneath your knees. And then still have a slouched, I'm slouching in my chair and get away from the microphone. But like, try, just put your toes like behind your knees in the chair and then try to slouch forward. You're like, oh, that's a weird and uncomfortable body position.
Like, well, yeah, because it pushes your hips forward, which pushes your back up. And then like, you can't do that and lean on something at the same time unless mm-hmm. you're in some weird, like, standing downward dog yoga pose. Like, yeah, it just kind of just takes that away from the natural position,
right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but more importantly, you get to use your toes to balance, which is like what make like you know, it's really hard to walk without toes, right? This is one of the reasons prosthetic limbs are crazy expensive. They're engineered to, like, let you walk in really weird ways because normally your toes are so crazy sensitive to tiny changes in balance. This is why you gain the magic ability to balance a motorcycle, because you're using your toes, like using the arches of your feet, like you're just turning your feet into bricks, right? The amount of articulation you get in your ankles and your toes when the heels or the arches of your feet are on your pegs versus the balls of your feet or your toes is crazy. Like it cuts your balance like tenfold. But, you know, at any rate of speed, the gyroscopic effects of the motorcycle cancel that out. So people don't think about it. But slow speed maneuver, or I mean, I don't even know if 15 miles an hour is considered a slow speed maneuver, whatever. It's just nowhere near as scary as you think it's going to be. And I wish there was a way to convey that to car drivers. The only thing I can think of is there are probably close to 1 million complete morons who operate two-wheeled vehicles that do this every day in California and Britain and, like, say, France alone. And people are not dying left and right. In fact, they're probably getting into accidents at a lower rate than everywhere else. So, like, how do you think at this point, like, 8 states or whatever would have, at the very least, ambiguous, if not outright, legal ways to lane split if this was actively more dangerous
state that require that, like, essentially requires everyone to conduct a study or put a sticker on everything to say that it may give you cancer also has this law on the books that allows people to do this daily? How do you square those two things, thinking that it's dangerous?
Yeah, California and the UK may be two of the highest concentration of pearl clutchers on the fucking planet. And there's no moral outrage about this.
Yeah. So.
Okay. We've done half an hour on lane splitting, but you knew we were going to when this day came, right? This day's been coming since we started this podcast. All right, best worst bike now. What do you think?
Let's do it.
Okay, so this is the segment where we have each chosen a motorcycle. We don't know what each other have chosen. It's always a surprise. Swigs, you are going to tell the people an email address. What is that email address?
Why do you have to do this? One time.
Are you delaying because you're not sure if you remember it?
If you have any questions, comments, complaints, send your feedback to contact@nokomotopodcast.com.
Yeah. If you are triggered, like some sort of backwards redneck in an F-250 being passed by a motorcycle filtering in traffic, send it to Connor. All right. So you have best bike in the world this week.
I do.
And are you ready to reveal it?
I am.
Okay. And the best bike in the world this week is?
The 2024 Moto Guzzi Stelvio.
Oh, okay. I haven't really looked at, you know what? I've heard, like, power numbers on this. I've heard a bunch about the engine. I haven't actually laid eyes on this. Okay. First thought, actually putting eyes on this, I'm a little disappointed. Because the Stelvio was sort of the reinvention of the Norge, right?
Yes.
And the Stelvio, whilst definitely being much more adventure-y than the Norge, still didn't go full-on adventure bike aesthetics. It had something a little unique about it. It was like, hey, this isn't just like the Italian Tenere or the Italian Africa Twin. This is, you know, a little bit of its own funky thing. The styling on this has gone a lot more middle-of-the-road adventure bike, which will please people, but I don't know. So, tell me more.
So, there's a few things about this that I think essentially do what a bike in this category should do. So, yeah, the Stelvio is kind of a more adventure... I mean, I'm not going to call it adventure bike because it's not an adventure bike. It in no way is capable of any sort of significant off-road adventure. In fact, right. I would be
so
kind of skeptical.
So why make it look like a fucking Tenere?
On that, that is probably the biggest downside of this bike. But this bike is essentially a touring machine in which it is very capable at. It has very good performance. It's got the 1 liter liquid cooled motor that the V100 Mandello has. It's got all the things that you would want for touring in terms of reliability, like having a shaft drive, having all the rider aids, having the weight down low, having, you know, a 5.5 gallon tank and ridiculously long range. And it does all of that while being a statement in that you went for the Moto Guzzi. And you can do all the things that all the BMW riders can do, all the Ducati guys can do on the Multistrada in terms of distance, all the things that everybody with a Concourse can do or a Goldwing can do. Well, the Goldwing's probably a level above, but we'll leave that out for now. But it does it while making its own statements. Because, you know, I think, what is it, Moto Guzzi sales are like something like 0.3% of the U.S. market. It is that niche brand. It's really, really, it's really, really small. But because of that, it also carries a level of prestige in and of itself where you come up to it and you're like, oh, it's Italian. And I've never heard of this bike before. And it's, oh, look at these lines. It's crazy. And, you know, and you see all the weird stuff on the dash and everything because Italians...
You get the funkiness and some of the credibility of buying a Ducati without it being so precious.
Right. And that's the other thing about this is that to buy this highway touring machine, what do you think the MSRP on this is?
I'm going to go with $13,900.
Okay, it's not that low. This is a flagship touring bike.
Oh, is it? Like, I don't know how loaded with features it is. I don't...
This has all the different rider modes. It's got the traction control and everything.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, this is... What size are the forks?
I actually...
Do you have a spec sheet?
I can pull that up.
So we got the Does it have a big TFT?
I believe so.
Okay, if it's got a big TFT, then it's 16,900.
You're very close. It's 16,500.
Okay, there we go.
Yeah,
I thought this was just kind of a bigger TT85. That's kind of like where it was in my mind. Like, oh, this is the big TT85, the Stelvio. But if it's actually more in that BMW GS range in terms of features, then yeah, we're looking at 16 to 17.
Yeah. So, let me see. I think I have the specs up here. What's the fork size?
Because this is the same, you said this is the same, essentially, it's not the same, but this motor is based off the V100 Mandello motor, right?
Yeah, I think it's the same motor D2.
Tuned differently. It's got like a different crank in it. The stroke is off or something.
Essentially, imagine a Norge with 25 more horsepower.
Yeah, this gets up to like 100 horsepower. Right, yeah.
115.
Oh, that much. Okay. I mean, some people for a big touring bike are going to be like, that's not enough. My JS1300's got 160 horsepower, bubble. Like, fuck you. Whatever. You can't use that.
How many BMW, how many GS1300s have actually hit peak horsepower?
Like seven, you know?
Right. Like, it doesn't happen.
Like, only the ones that have been taken to Mugello, right?
Right. But you can kind of get that experience on something, you know, without spending $25,000. And you can do it with a bit more character. You can do it with very similar or basically the same rider aids and all the kind of flagship electronic features. And I think that's worth noting that, weirdly, in many ways, Moto Guzzi can be a big pain. But in this regard, you know, having a few mechanical issues or parts supply issues versus paying another 10 grand up front, it's actually very compelling. And it will do, and it'll do it in a way that kind of sets you apart a lot more. And because it's really, really not ever meant to actually go off-road, the fact that it can't do anything adventure-ish like the GS, you know, 1300R, or I always get the letters and the numbers mixed up, but like the BMW flagship, it's kind of also a little bit more legit to just show up at the coffee shop with and to pose with a bit as well.
If I was going to be dropping that kind of coin on that style of bike, I would definitely be like, okay, what's like the what's really in the $1,000 difference between this and an Africa Twin? I'd have to be like, well, I'm a Honda guy, but I'm also a Moto Guzzi guy. Like, yeah, I might take $20 a month more on the payments to have the Moto Guzzi specialness, right? I like this. In that, of this category of bike that I'm not a huge fan of, I like these motors. Well, I mean, I haven't ridden this specific motor, but if it's anything like other Moto Guzzi engines, then I'm going to be a big fan. I have not ridden a Moto Guzzi liquid cooled engine yet, so I'd have to do a test ride to see. But if we're just putting the specs next to each other, this versus a Tenere or BMW GS or Africa Twin, you know, I'm probably going to end up going, well, do I need this, or is the 850, you know, TT going to be plenty enough also? It might come down to which one's actually more comfortable.
Well, I'd only go for the TT because it would potentially, I mean, I haven't seen anyone do anything vaguely off-road with the TT85, but I presume that it's not actually off-road capable.
You know, I'm going to say with a tire change, I believe that the Stelvio is fully adventure capable, because hot take, any bike can be an adventure bike. I have ridden V-twin Supersports off-road, okay? It really has more to do with just how up for adventure you are than the motorcycle you're on. And this doesn't look unadventury, so...
I mean, I have done forest trails on the Stella. And you did a hill climb with the PX150 as well.
I also did logging roads on what's-his-face's BMW K1200.
I don't know if I'm aware of this.
Not K1200. What?
Byron?
No, we're at MotoGP with him. He won the rider gear giveaway that they never made good on.
I thought it was Byron.
No, it's not Byron. It's but I'm gonna remember in a second. I feel like such an asshole. He's such a cool guy. Anyway, his BMW like inline four.
Oh, the K1300.
It was a 1200, but yeah, it was the one before the
13. It was a 13.
No, his was the 12, the predecessor to the 13. Anyway, his BMW Busa. He and I like went with Mike on a big ride, and I rode it on like a logging road, like a fire trail, essentially. Like it was fine. So the point is that this looks like it's got plenty of ground clearance. It looks like it's got like very good suspension. It looks like you really just need to give it 50-50 or off-road tires, and I'd fucking adventure it. It looks the part. And if it looks the part, it has the power, it has ground clearance, and it has suspension, why is it not an off-road bike? Everyone acts like if it can't go up the fucking side and reach the top of K12, it's not an adventure bike. This is bullshit. You know what? I'm going to declare it. The Stelvio is not only adventure capable. Before riding it, I think it is one of the most capable off-road adventure bikes on the market today. Come at me. I bet you within 12 months, we will see a video of somebody doing big adventure things with this. I have seen videos of people doing Honda, like old school Honda Transalp suspension swaps on NC750s and claiming that it's an amazing off-road bike. Like, and they've got GoPro footage to back their shit up. Okay? This has tall, long travel suspension and big ground clearance, and it's weighted the same way as other adventure bikes. It's got bark busters and, you know, all the adventure things on it. Why is it not an adventure bike? Why is it not capable? Go actually, fuck yourselves,
it's
public.
So it's 540 pounds wet, which is actually kind of on the lighter side for
a big tourer. Yeah. What people say that, oh, the Africa Twin's not really an adventure bike. I don't know. I see a lot of people doing adventures with it.
I've also seen people doing tabletops with gold wings. that doesn't mean you should. I'm wondering on a 1300 GS, what's the wet weight on that?
I thought it was around 580. Just for, like, the basic bike with no luggage. It was, like, kind of big, but not as big as you think. For the size of a BMW GS when it's fully loaded versus just the stripped-down frame one, it's not as heavy as you would think. But I could be way off base on that. It might be 600 and something. But I thought it was a kind of high 500s.
It's actually about the same.
Yeah.
Oh, but this is for the 2024. I don't know if the older ones are heavier. I'll have to look them up for
whatever. Heavier.
But yeah, okay. So
everyone has to qualify. Well, this is really more of a highway than an adventure. Blah, 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 blah. Really? I think this is one of those things, you know, like riding dirt, where rider skill plays a way bigger factor than the equipment. I went down a YouTube rabbit hole a few months ago of top level motocross riders racing vintage bikes, and they're still pulling off some amazing shit. So, when you're off road adventuring, your skill is a much bigger factor than the bike. So I'm just going to call all of these bikes legitimate adventure bikes from now on. I'm not making the, well, it's a little bit more road-oriented, blah, blah. Here's my regurgitated, boring take on adventure bikes.
To a degree, yeah. I mean, there's also just kind of the factor of, like, what do people actually use them for?
Oh, because sure. But if we're talking about the bike itself, like, you know, if it looks like a duck and it swims like a duck, right? Like, what's the fucking difference, right? Just because, like, if you took two Dakar racing professionals, is one superior to the other? What the fuck do I care? I'm never going to like spend. I can't go back. I'm 40 years old. I can't go back in time and spend my early teens training to ride across the desert to be on the level and athletic level and skill level that these guys are on. That whether I've got a factory built racing, you know, Tenere versus just a stock Stelvio with some 50-50 tires, it's not going to make a fucking difference.
Yeah, I mean, and this is mainly an aesthetic thing, but it's, and it is kind of a little bit of a shit test, but it's like the difference between having, between people. Okay, so I'm going to go back to trucks for a second, because this is something that really pisses me off, and it actually affects me in a big way, because I'd like a new truck, but I can't buy one.
Because they don't make the one you want.
Because they don't make the one I want.
Not even close, in fact.
And we're in a world now where people call the Ford Maverick a pickup truck. And the Ford Maverick is not a pickup truck. The Ford Maverick has barely any payload capacity, middling towing capacity, and is essentially an SUV that had the rear part of the roof chopped off, which turns it into a pickup truck instead of an SUV,
not to mention
which
the
is
Maverick.
Actually mostly being used the same way that somebody would use a station wagon or a fucking minivan. And now this entirely different family vehicle segment is now taking over this pickup truck market, and they do different things. And yet now pickup trucks, you know, in heavy quotes, pickup trucks are now being overtaken by this market of fucking minivan users. And
oh, yeah. Claire and I are looking very seriously at buying her parents' like 2016 or 2013 Sienna. And one of the reasons is it's so much more capable at moving huge volumes of shit than a pickup truck. It's like, ridiculous. You pull the seats out. You just press a button, pull the seats out, and it's got so much space. And if it's something dirty, put a fucking tarp down. Like, whatever. It's a fucking minivan. Well, also, I was going to say about the Maverick. The big reason the Maverick is categorically not a pickup truck. Like a pickup, it's not. If we were biologists, we would say the Maverick isn't even in the same clade as pickup trucks, because the defining aspect of a pickup truck versus a truck is that it comes with customizable options. Originally, a pickup truck was a cab on a frame. And then you would get it delivered with whatever options, flatbed, fleet side, you know, whatever options, whatever, right? But as far as I know, the Maverick just kind of comes as it comes. So it is not a pickup truck. It would be, if I was a biologist, I would say the Maverick is genetically closer to like a Ford Expedition than it is an F-150.
Or a Chevy Blazer. Like,
a Chevy Blazer, it's on a customizable platform, though. That's a tough call. Anyway.
Well, the unibody aspect of it definitely makes it not a pickup truck. But also just in terms of the specifications. Like, I feel like we should just create a class of actual pickup trucks. We can come up with a better term later, but it needs to have at least a 6-foot bed.
I would be happy to bring back El Caminos. Like, the pickup truck I want is like an old like Mazda, like, yeah, B2000, or is that Nissan?
I mean,
whichever, whatever. Yeah, the old, like, B2000 like pickup truck that was, mm-hmm, barely more than a car. Like,
yeah, I mean, like an S10 is infinitely more of a pickup truck than a Ford Maverick is.
I'm a huge fan of the S10. I had an S10 with the V6 Vortec Somehow, I don't even understand how, because I didn't know shit about fuck at the time. This is like right after high school. It had a little bit of a lift on it. It had the 3-door cab, it had the premium sound, and the bed was rhino lined. And holy shit, this truck was just fucking awesome. It got almost 30 miles to the gallon, which was a big deal for any fucking truck in like 2003. And it, I don't know, the truck was just fucking awesome, and I got it for like $5,000 even. And when some girl was playing hooky from school, pulled out in front of me and I T-boned her, I got like $8,500 in insurance money. Like, one of the best vehicles I've ever owned in my life. And if the same truck was put in front of me today, I would just fucking buy it. I just, regardless of anything else happening financially in my life, I'd be like, it's worth the credit hit, Claire. We're doing this. Like, we're buying this piece of shit truck because long term, this is going to be a great decision and we're both going to be happy about it.
Anyway, the point I was trying to make is that we all end up getting the products we actually want when we're all not living under this insane collective delusion of something being something that it isn't. And it would be better if we could have a little bit more authenticity in calling the bikes what they actually are and not being a bunch of fucking posers.
Yeah, weirdly, by downgrading this bike, you're being a poser. Normally, posers are trying to, like, inflate and upgrade things. But when you look at this bike and you call it not a real adventure bike, you're insinuating that what you have is, whether you're adventuring or not.
All right, we're just gonna have to crowdsource the sick Stelvio off road video.
Let's just ask the listeners, yeah. Even if it's just a thumbs up or thumbs down like emoji, right? Everyone send in an email. Do you vote the Stelvio as an adventure bike or not? You don't even like just write yes or no. Just everybody vote in on this because I'd like to tally up the responses that we get. Is our argument convincing?
I guess we should ask, just in general, how many of these supposed adventure bikes do people think are actually adventure bikes? Whether it's the
BMW... Well, I'm taking the argument that you look at it like a voltmeter, right? Is it positive or negative? Right. Uh-huh. If you're putting in positive charge, it's straight up an adventure bike. I don't care at what level.
Does that include for like the NC750X?
Yes.
Okay. All right.
There's a lot of YouTube footage of people adventuring them.
Is there?
Oh, yeah. Stubbornly, just to prove that it can be done. But yes, there is.
All right. We may have to revisit this at some point. Okay. Well, we're like probably like 15 minutes off of talking about the Stelvio, so we should probably move on to the next
one. I want to throw out one other thing. I'm not quite finished. I want what's his face? Like Zach, whoever at fucking Revzilla or something. These fucking asshats that are putting out all these videos where they're like, I don't know, recreating the Dumb and Dumber Pikes Peak or taking monkey bikes to Baja or whatever the fuck that they're doing. These people that are like the gatekeepers of what is and isn't adventure or whatever. I want someone to name the road or trail that a motorcycle is able to do to be a quote real adventure bike. Cause like, well, I mean, it could do like fire trails or whatever, but it can't do the real stuff. What road or trail is like the bare minimum that you call the real stuff? I want to see photographs and a description of this magical point where something is or isn't a real adventure bike. Because if that cannot be produced, as long as it fits the styling criteria of an adventure bike, in my book now, it just is an adventure bike. I'm just so over this, like, well, it's an adventure bike for suburban dads, like, kind of thing. Like, no, it is or it isn't.
I don't know. It goes both ways.
No, it does.
It does.
It just means stupid.
I don't know. Okay.
I'm ready to move on now. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Here we go. And the worst mic in the world this week is. I think it's 1996 to 2003, but I could be wrong on the dates there. The Yamaha YZF600R. Not since Garnished Wages has something sounded so good, but been so disappointing in reality. Has something sounded way better than it actually is? The YZF600R.
It's so tragic because the previous generation of this bike, I think, has some of the best graphics.
I know. With the X-Up bikes?
Yeah. Just with the straight-up, like, jazz.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my God. There were so many. I mean,
Let's bring up a picture here, because this is the part where, you know, listeners click on the provided image and we talk
about
this.
There's nothing more vaporwave than the previous generation of this bike.
I know. So, this bike is stylistically and emotionally a mix between like a Ninja 500 and the first generation Ducati Multistrada.
But he looks so happy.
Well,
so it's got a little bit of a Minion thing going on with the, yeah.
So this is a category of bike that doesn't exist anymore. And I wish this category of bike did exist. So in the late 90s and even a little bit into the early 2000s, we had this strange category of bikes which people would constantly argue, much like whether or not something is a true adventure bike, people would argue whether or not these were true super sports. So, sadly, my ZZR 600 Ninja was in the category of this bike. Now, these were bikes that were somewhere between 90 or 89 and 105 horsepower, liquid cooled. Actually, no, not even always liquid cool, but inline four, 600 cc's. Now, the one that everyone remembers is the second gen Katana.
Mm-hmm. Oh, this is the Thundercat.
Yes.
Okay, yeah.
It was never known as the Thundercat here, but you say, like, okay, late 90s, early 2000s, YZF600R. Oh, you're talking about an R6. No, I am not talking about an R6. This is the bike that if you bought it, you were hoping people would confuse for an R6. But this is styling and performance-wise nowhere fucking near. This is one of those bikes that had a horrible transmission where second gear would get chewed out. This is the worst example of the 90s single headlight look. This might be the worst sport bike headlight in the history of sport bike headlights.
It's pretty bad, yeah.
It's pretty bad. This was when every one of these, like, second-tier 600s, not the full-on race bikes, right? These are the second-tier 600s. These are the bargain 600s.
This is...
They would still have Ram Air, but they all put the Ram Air in this one little, like, graded section underneath the headlight, and they gave every single one of these bikes a double chin. Whether it was the ZZR, whether it was the Katana, whether it's the YZF600R, whatever, all of these bikes got a double chin with a weird Ram Air intake, a terrible single headlight, and they were meant to look like they had true super sport performance, but they didn't quite. It was still good performance for the day, but they would fuck up things on these bikes, like put on very 70s or 80s turn signals. They would never have the fun graphics that the real double R bikes had.
Here's a question for you. Looking at this picture that we're looking at right now, just looking at the bike head on, is that just a sealed beam behind a plastic cover? Is this actually a custom like housing for a bulb? Or is this... Because it, I mean, if it is custom, that's actually worse for it because
I
it
think
looks,
these, yeah, no,
it
I,
looks
I don't
like
think
a sealed
these,
beam.
These are not
the
sealed beams. No, these were real headlights.
But it looks like a sealed beam.
I know, I know. It's so terrible. The only thing that this bike has going for it is this is the Yamaha, I think, first generation of the Delta box frame. So this has a real perimeter frame like an R6 would, whereas like the Katana and the ZZR600 really had something that's a little bit more like a cradle frame that was covered up with bodywork to make it look like a perimeter frame bike like these. This at least did have a real sport bike frame, and the handling's okay, and the power is like good to okay, but this bike was made irrelevant, like in the middle of its existence. Like a lot of motorcycles get discontinued and replaced by something that blows them out of the water. This was made irrelevant in 1999 by the R6, but they yet still built it into 2003. Could you imagine buying this in 2003? When the 636 Ninja exists, when the R6 exists, when the CBR 600RR exists, why on earth would you choose this? The only conceivable reason is better ergonomics. But when you're at the height of the speed wars, like this is the poor person's choice, right? This is... Well, it's what they would approve me for. I just didn't have the extra cash or whatever. It's an embarrassment, right? If Vanilla Ice had to ride one of these, he would have hung himself. And it's just like, why did it go until 2003? Like, nobody wanted this. It was embarrassing then, and it's embarrassing now. It is easier to ride a second gen Katana, ironically, than to ride one of these.
Yeah, so I mean, I think there's a little bit of a tragedy here because. This was kind of a fairly high performance bike when it was originally created, but like completely superseded by the R6. Whereas nowadays, manufacturers have a little bit more of a, I mean, and it shouldn't have gone on for as long as it did. That was kind of ridiculous. But nowadays we actually have, nowadays, manufacturers have very well kind of delineated like performance and kind of budget bikes. You know, from like 2005 to like 2020, I guess for some brands still going on, you know, we have like the 650 class as kind of like the budget detuned model, right? But this just directly competed as an inline four with a much better inline four from the same brand, which makes no sense.
I mean, the only bike in this category that makes any sense is the Honda CBR 600 F4i. Now, that bike would slice off, say, like, 10 to 15 horsepower from this one, but it would make up for it in the fuel injection, the torque and power band, and 10x better styling.
I think the F4i was 10 more horsepower than this.
I thought this was about 100 horsepower and the F4i was about 90.
I thought the F4i I thought the F4i was 110.
Was it really? Well, it's definitely only 90 at the rear wheel, and this is probably 85 at the rear wheel, if we're honest. But the just the simple fact that it was fuel injected over this being carbureted at the time just
maybe it was 700. Yeah, I have to check. I thought it was higher.
I thought the F4i was a little lower. I thought the F4i was more like 90 horsepower and 80 at the crank, at the rear wheel. But it makes up for it in maintenance, styling, just the street cred of the bike, a lot of different things.
Okay, so I found somebody who ran their F4i on a dyno, and after putting 160,000 miles on it, it put out 95.
There you go. Okay. So,
I think 110 original is probably accurate.
Okay, cool. Yeah. But this was like 100 supposedly original and probably at the crank. Mm. So, yeah, if you were going to go for one of these sort of more relaxed super sports, I would say the F4i is where super sports really begin. This is definitely a sport bike, but is it a super sport? I don't know.
Yeah. Okay.
But it's trying so embarrassingly hard to be a super sport. Now, is the, 100 horsepower at the crank and 40 foot-pounds of torque, which might also only be more like 36 at the rear wheel, still enjoyable? Probably. There's something to just revving the shit out of a slightly underpowered sport bike that's kind of exciting because it makes cool-ish noises when you get it up that high, but it's not, it's just so much in the shadow of the R6. And we talk a lot about how we love 90s sport bike aesthetics and styling, but this specific class of the 90s sport bikes doesn't follow a lot of those rules.
Yeah. Well, I think you also have to remember that when the R6 came out, it was just fucking bananas.
It was a sea change in the super sport world.
It was, hey, we're not doing so well currently in the 600 class, which Suzuki basically invented. How can we pull ahead? Well, let's turn it into an arms race. Let's take all of the specs and all the features we have on our superbike and let's put it on our 600cc platform and essentially just scale it down and just throw money at the problem. And that was the arms race that Yamaha started. And in that regard, yeah, there's no way this could ever compete. But at the same time, once they had done that, there was no reason for this to exist anymore. And it went on for an embarrassingly long time.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's such a take of a snobby journalist at the time as well to be like, because I was, it's 100 horsepower. That's plenty for anybody. Blah, 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 blah. But this was being sold in 2003, and it looks like it's from 1992. And these days, you could probably get away
that's
with
not
a
true.
Year gap.
No, that's not true. It would look way cooler if it was from 1992. Okay.
Well, I'm saying the body shape. But yeah, the paint jobs on these were embarrassingly simple and not nearly cool enough. The only thing they got right about this was the name. YZF600R sounds fucking awesome. Really the biggest problem is there was also like a YZ600F that was even worse. And it had this strange paint job with like stars on it and shit. That was more like an 80-something horsepower 600 that was released in like 04 or something. Somehow they made a version of this afterwards that was even more of a downgrade. And I probably should have picked that as worst bike. But it's hard to understand how embarrassing it was to have a bike like this at the time. It seems impossible today, but more of the public knew the difference than you'd think. There's a lot of people who buy motorcycles right now, and you go to bike meetups, and they're, you know, if you're going to own one, okay, sorry, you go to bike meetups today, and just everyone shows up with a bike, and having a bike is often cool enough. Right. And I'm glad we live in that world. I don't want to go back to this 90s world. I want to be clear. But what you got when you bought an R6 instead of one of these was way worth it. And I just want to point out that we love 90s bikes, but not necessarily all of them. And I owned one of this class of bike, and I enjoyed every minute of owning it. But would I buy another one? Fuck no. Would I buy a 1999 R6? Yes. But I have no interest in this downgraded 600 double chin, single headlights, way too many different pieces of bodywork, boring paint scheme world of mild 690s, 600s.
Well, you say double chin. I see on there what looks like a set of almost kind of proto winglets.
Well, right, because they had to rely on the Ram Air to make that last couple bits of horsepower, because if they couldn't put out a bike that wasn't at least 100 horsepower at this time, no one would fucking buy it. So the only way they could do that is have this aerodynamic thing go on at the front, where they had to suck in air, but they couldn't make it like just a big fucking scoop that just caught air like a fucking Dodge Charger, right? Or Challenger or whatever. They had to move that bike around because that slight difference in the aerodynamics, it was going to make the difference between this being a bike that could actually hit speeds they claimed or not. And yeah, it doesn't matter. What matters is it's just not something that makes sense to own today. It's not something that's collectible that anyone really remembers fondly. It wasn't competitive in its day. It was budget in its day. It's just history's not really going to remember this bike, and there's no reason to really revisit it other than in this context of how inferior it was. And like I said, if you go to a bike meet now, people are like, oh, you're just some whatever. If you went to a bike meet back then, it was a lot of like, well, who's top dog now? It wasn't just good enough to have a bike. There were a couple rich kids in my high school that would show up on some hot shit, and there were some guys that would show up on just whatever, and there was a clear line, right? Like the late 90s, early 2000s, there was a lot of cheap credit rolling around. In 2003, a friend of mine called a dealership in Indianapolis and for $400 down with no credit application, got a 636 delivered to his house. And he signed for it at the door. That's how easy it was to get a bike that blew this out of the water.
I mean, $400 a month in 2003 was kind of a lot, but the no credit check is
Right. So yeah, if you insane. Were rocking this in 03, it was – or maybe it was 05 or 06. But we're within enough that like I'm just – I can confuse dates easily. Like this was just not at all relevant. Mm.
A shame.
Yep. Okay. It's a shame. Okay. So, hour and 20 minutes, and we're only finishing with. Do we want to move on to our adventures yesterday?
Sure. We'll see that real quick. Yeah.
So, you tried to buy something yesterday.
I did. Yeah. And. You know, it looked promising. It turned out not to be. so we went and checked out an ad for an 86 Honda Elite Deluxe.
The CH150. This is the scooter with the flip-up headlight.
Yeah. And going into it, we knew that there was going to be quite a few things wrong with this bike. We knew that this is not going to be a pristine show model piece that we were looking at. But it turned out to be an incredible level of disaster.
Well, not since we tried to buy those two big Ruckus have we encountered someone just so...
It's Ruckusai.
The Ruckai or whatever.
The Ruckai, yeah.
Have we just tried to buy something from this level of a clown? First of all, the guy was super twitchy. Like, he was, like, on meth or withdrawing. Or he just had desperation oozing out of his pores. He was struggling to open the gate to the storage facility.
We were sat behind him for like a full minute while he tried to put the key code in.
New rule. If someone asked you to meet them to buy a motorcycle that's not on property they own, just don't show up. If the vehicle is not on property they own, just don't show up. If they're like, yeah, I need you to meet me at a storage unit. I need you to meet me at a McDonald's. I need you to meet me at a truck stop. You need to meet me at my friend's house. Just don't show up. This is a red flag that people really don't bring up often enough. But nothing good is going to happen from someone trying to sell a vehicle that they can't even store themselves.
That's probably a good sign, yeah. That's probably a good measure, yeah. Okay, so going into this, so we meet this guy at a storage lot.
A sketchy storage lot.
Yeah, it's not a building with individual roll-up door, like timber doors or anything. It's a gravel lot full of shipping containers.
Yeah.
It takes him like a solid minute to open the door, and like I saw him pull his phone out at the time, like looking up what the code was, and then taking another 30 seconds to enter the code into the keypad to get the door to open.
While he's, like, visibly, like, twitchy and, like, in a hurry and flailing around.
Yeah. We pull in. He gets the bike out with a lot of exposition. Also, generally, a little bit of a red flag. pulls it out. And straight away, the bike doesn't start.
Yeah, the battery's dead. So I, at this point, you offered that you had a jump box, and I couldn't believe it. I was like, this thing's already looks like a big piece of shit. This is it, like, it doesn't start is like, hey, it doesn't run. The ad said it runs great. That is, you just had your out right there. You could have been like, great, it doesn't start, and walked away. And he'd be like, oh, you're leaving? You'd be like, it doesn't start. Your ad said it runs great. Like, the ad explicitly said in more than one place
okay,
two that things this thing there. Ran like a champ.
Two things. One, I was already 2 hours into this adventure because I had to go to a fucking raffle with you.
Well, I did have a reason to order a part at that dealership. To be fair.
Yeah. So I was already out a lot of my weekend time already coming up. And it's like, so let's see if this is because, I mean, secondly, it's April. And
well, I was going to float you the cash, like, should you, the extra cash, should you have needed to buy it. I feel like just us riding and just stopping off on the way to order a part at the Honda dealership and then wait around half an hour longer to see if we could win a bright canary yellow Honda Fury was worth it.
Okay. Secondly, okay, so, I mean, obviously the guy pulled out of storage, started it. He thought I ran great. The thing hasn't seen a battery tender in, like, probably multiple years.
Since the Reagan years.
Yeah. So I was like, all right, let's just put a battery tender on it. Let's get the jump box. Let's get it just started. And it did start up well, in fairness. So I was like, okay, we're already in here. Let's just see if there's something here. So it started up. And then I rode it basically down the frontage road and back. Few things about that. The bike's topped out at like 45 miles an hour. And not like topped out as in that's as far as I got before I got to the intersection. It was in like the bike was crawling up to 45 miles an hour after it hit like 38 miles an hour. Indicated speed on a bike that supposedly
and this thing
will
should
be...
have been eager up to about like 52 and then crawled up to like 60. Yeah.
Right. So.
So we're low on compression at the very least here.
Right. Then. Yeah. And before I took off, I checked some of the controls. The headlight did not turn on.
Not only did the headlight not turn on, it didn't flip up.
Yeah, the key feature of the bike. The turn signals didn't work.
Well, the rear ones weren't even there.
Yeah, there's that. There was no front brake. Which, in fairness to him...
That was the only thing he qualified, because he's like, well, they'll notice that. The other shit, maybe they won't fucking notice and I can get away with this con.
Well, he said that he was upfront about the fact that it needed the front brake replaced. But he also indicated that he had a front brake cable for it, which he didn't.
Yeah.
Also, the controls on the dash didn't work. I assume they were disconnected because like the clock was not functional.
Right.
Not only was the clock not functional, the trip meter was not functional, nor was the flip from kilometers to miles an hour, miles per hour for the speedo also wasn't functional. Got back. He then claimed that it had a new rear tire.
He claimed both the tires were new, right? And I just, as he said, oh, it's got new tires, I looked at it and I was like, on this front tire, the entire sidewall is cracked everywhere. And he looks at it and goes, oh, well, I guess that one's a little bit old. But this back one, that's new. And at
there's
this point,
more wear on it than the front tire
at this point, I was like, I'm just going to be quiet now. But you were like, it's bald. And I was like, yeah. Because my thought was like, I can't say anything else now without directly insinuating that you're lying to our face. Like, without calling you out, I can't make any more comments here. Because it's just me calling you a liar about what's plainly in front of our eyes. That is a bald rear tire, which That rear tire might have been from 1998. The front tire must have been the original.
So, this goes deeper as well. So, he also had lost the original key.
Yeah. And he put it in an aftermarket, like, just generic ignition, like, not even a standard Honda ignition. Yeah.
Which also, he struggled to insert and turn to actually turn the bike on.
Yeah.
And he tried to, like, shove the key in and bump it like he was picking a lock when we got there. But also, because it's a bike with a key for the to lift the seat up to get to the fuel tank, it's a key to like system. So after he replaced the ignition cylinder, he just took the latch off of the seat. So the rear seat just like wasn't latched down either.
Yeah. The seat latch didn't work. Also, he mentioned like 15 times that it had a title, but every time he mentioned the title, he had another weird thing to say about it.
Oh yeah, he had a title. Transferred from another state.
He never produced this title. Yeah, if you had it transferred from another state and then it was a Colorado title, like, why even mention that? Just be like, I have a clean Colorado title for this bike. But he had to mention, oh, it's got a title. And he said it enough times, I was like, I guarantee the title. This bike is not currently registered. There's no way it's registered in his name. And there's got to be something else going on. He's talking about the title.
It's like a teenager walking up to the cashier at a liquor store with a case of beer being like, hello, I would like to legally purchase this alcohol with this ID that I have from the States.
I'm definitely 21, don't you know?
Yeah.
It's like McLovin. They're like, who's going to believe you're a 24-year-old organ donor from Hawaii? He's like, you can't, don't be so obvious just being 21. You can't just tell people that there's no issues with the title. They're not going to believe you. Right. Everything. And then you told him, you were like, I'm going to cut to the chase here. I'm walking away. And he's like, well, let me offer you something. You know, he's like, what about $800? But then he weirdly goes, there's no way I'm taking any less than that. And you're just like, yeah, I'm not interested. And he's like, I'm not going to take less than $800. And you're, and we're both like, yeah, we're leaving. Hey, I'm not taking less than $800.
I mean, I didn't say that right away, but I was.
You expressed to him that even before price was an issue, you were not interested in the amount of work that the bike was going to take to make it road legal.
Yeah.
And then he starts banging on about price and you're just like,
this was a bike that was like, okay, if I was a high school grad, I'm not going to college. I'm working, like, I'm going straight into work. And it's like, I really want a scooter and I'm going to just like take the biggest problem child I can, and I'm going to put all my time and effort into it. There's like some level of like nonsense you're going to put up with. But like, this was a bike that was basically, this would be for a person who had $600 and like
nothing but time
Because the electrical issues were, I mean, like,
yeah.
And also the point is, like, these are all the things that came up in like 10 minutes of looking at this bike. Those weren't going to be the only problems.
Yeah, we didn't remove a body panel. We didn't look at the inside of the gas tank. We didn't see like whether or not the exhaust was hanging on by a thread. We didn't look inside, like, you know, put the endoscope in the engine and see if there was like weird wear on the piston. We didn't check the valves. We didn't do compression. We didn't like test what was coming off the stator. Right.
Yeah.
Just, we didn't see, like, what, like, if there were, like, frame bolts that were rusted. So much. And then, like, everything that we pointed out very gently that was wrong, he was like, well, it was just working. Well, yeah, but it's not working now, buddy. And then he gets, like, almost, like, borderline indignant. I'm not taking less than 800. Like, okay, you know, and he's like, you know, for what it is, with low miles for the year, I mean, that's a great deal. Like he thought he had, like a Ferrari that had dents in it. It's like, no, this isn't cool to everybody, and it's just in bad shape. This is in bad shape, and only we kind of think it's cool.
Yeah, and if we're also being honest, 60,000 miles, while it is low for a lot, for a Honda.
You mean 6,000?
No, it was 60,000.
There's no way it had 60,000. Was it really?
It was 60,000.
That's a lot of miles for yeah. that thing. He kept talking about how great it runs, and it was like, it's running in front of us, and it's not running that great. Like, you can't just keep declaring. Like, it was like we were buying something from Donald Trump. Like, he just kept declaring how great it was, even though it was just evident to passing, like, squirrels that this wasn't running great.
Yeah. An objectively not road-legal machine in front of us.
Right. And to be not road-compliant as a scooter is really saying something. It doesn't take a lot, right? Doesn't take a lot. Yeah, there's not much else to say, but the moral of the story, kids, is don't be on meth and in a hurry to sell shit out of your shipping container. It's interesting. I had this thought as we were leaving, which was, you know, I'm annoyed sometimes at other scooter people being so snobbish. And I have to consider this possibility that a lot of the vintage scooter people that we deal with, probably as a matter of course, like trying to find cool scooter models like this or running scooter shops and people like this come into their shops with their disaster vehicles that are full of problems. Scooters have people who are willing to put in the time, effort, and money to take a vintage machine and make it run well and have it be really cool. But there's also this other dimension of scooter people who are just desperate people. And yeah. Maybe their snobbishness is a wall up against this.
It's probably a good fact. Yeah, that's probably a big factor. All right, let's take a quick break.
Okay. All right. Let's do the thing, and we'll be back in just a moment. Oh my gosh, where's the... You know what, we'll just use this one. And we are back. Okay, so couple things at the end of this episode here. Well, I mean, we've probably got 25 minutes left to go. Maybe more. But I'm going to give a little bit of a Lambretta update here. This is kind of a pretty big deal. So I've done this engine rebuild on the Lambretta. And I mean, this has been pretty good. I've rebuilt it as original, just totally stock engine rebuild. And Swigs, true or false, it is now a one kick bike.
It is.
There are
I saw
two
it
ways.
Multiple times.
There, I've probably started it on average about every 4 hours now since I finished the engine because I just can't believe that I rebuilt it and it's a one-kick motor. You can do it one of two ways. You can give it a tiny bit of throttle and just give it one kick and it goes up, or no throttle and put on the choke and give it one kick, and that's it. There's only one tiny issue with it. Well, it's not exactly a tiny issue, but there's one issue, which is that at idle, the float is kind of crappy, and there's really not much of a way to fix it. And if you let it idle for a long time, it will eventually get overfueled and bogged down and die. And then you've got to turn the fuel off and kick it through about 10 times, and then it'll start again after you blow all the extra gas out of it. But I believe, I haven't extensively road tested it yet, but I believe that at open throttle, the leakage from the float needle is little enough that it won't be an issue. So the only thing is that if I sit at an especially long red light with this thing, that might become an issue when I start extensively road testing it. So I may have to just say fuck it and buy a new carburetor, because the float mechanism is ridiculously primitive. I mean, it is early 1940s primitive. But whatever. I'm going to try to get a little cutting paste and rub the needle, like twist the needle inside of the float mechanism, and see if I can get the two surfaces to mate a little bit better. But as it is, I think we have as good carburation, compression, and exhaust and everything as we did back in the day. There, I have fixed the exhaust leak. I have fixed the compression with a bore, new piston and cylinders. I have made sure, at least for now, everything inside the drive side of the engine is okay to handle the massive 5.5 horsepower that it supposedly makes. Yes, shockingly, like the chain's not in too bad a situation. Everything, every gasket that needed to replace is good. There are zero leaks anywhere in the motor, and I'm now just putting it back together. And one of the big things that was holding it back and preventing me from getting the carburetor tuned correctly was that it had wildly the wrong spark plug in it, which caused me to go down a deep rabbit hole about spark plugs and what actually is important about something having the correct or incorrect spark plug. And it turns out that there are more reasons than you think to be selecting the correct spark plug. And I thought this is worth sharing with everyone, because Dad is guilty. Our father is guilty of this, of just being like, it's like the right thread spark plug, right? It's like the right size. It'll be fine, right? Just put a spark plug in there.
Right, yeah.
And it turns out this is, even in the 50s, nowhere near close to being good enough. Forget like modern cars and like iridium spark plugs and shit. Like, going back to the 50s, you need the right spark plug. So the first thing is the size, right? There's basically four different sizes of spark plugs. You know, and that's, you know, which spark plug puller you're going to use to, you know, put the spark plug in or out, right?
Yeah.
So first of all, will it fucking thread in, right? That's a question you have to ask.
The lowest bar that you can meet.
Right.
Yeah.
Will it actually go in without fucking up the threads in the head of your engine?
Or getting smacked by the piston head.
Right, yeah. Will the engine completely turn, right, when the spark plug's in there? Yeah, will you be using a spark plug too long and it becomes a positive stop, right? Turns out if you turn your starter and, second thing. So first of all, is it the correct size? That sounds like a simple yes and no, but there's a couple different dimensions to this. You just talked about the threaded section of the plug being too long. Well, you would rather it be too short than too long, but too short is a problem also. So it turns out that if you're using a plug that's too short, from what I've read, you really don't want the spark plug to be further away than, for any given like optimum RPM range, like 5 millimeters away from the optimum point where it should be firing. Now, it's not possible for the plug to move around at various RPMs for it to be in the optimum point to ignite the fuel mixture in it. Because depending on what speed your engine's turning, that exact point inside the cylinder where it's optimum to have the spark plug changes a bit. So where the spark plug hole is in your the head of your engine is a compromise of the best place it could be for the overall RPM range. Because depending on what RPM your engine is doing, where the concentration of fuel is in your cylinder changes a little bit.
Yeah, so there is a compromise. But some positions are objectively better than others.
Right. And I'll tell you, the worst position is recessed into the head. Not to mention, you also, and this, and while it might seem trivial, a engine makes a little bit different kind of power and has a slightly meaningfully different amount of compression just based on the carbon buildup over time. What if it's recessed a quarter inch into the head? That's a meaningful difference on the amount of compression you now have.
Well, it's also going to affect
the amount of... So you're not getting as good a burn, which is going to lead to buildup on the plug, not to mention the fact that it's in a spot where it's not going to burn as much of the fuel also.
Right. And if it's in a place... Well, and I suspect this is what happened... for my bike is with Stella is that I did just go get spark plugs down at O'Reilly's, which I looked it up and supposedly they were good, but probably not the exact model that was required. And it only took maybe 50 miles for those spark plugs to get fouled up.
Right. And the reason for that, I discovered, because you were buying spark plugs that were the correct length and correct size, but they were still the wrong spark plug by far. So it's not just the size. And it really doesn't have the spark plugs. It turns out it doesn't make that much difference. How much, like, you know, the quality of the spark coming through it. So there's the gap. On the plug. So if you have any kind of owner's manual for your vehicle, and you can probably just Google this as well, you can figure out what the gap is supposed to be for your spark plug. And the gap is something that you can set yourself, because spark plugs don't come gapped correctly for your vehicle necessarily. They might be sort of in the ballpark range, but there's a little tool you can buy at any auto parts store for about $4, and it's a little ring of metal with little steps around the side of it, and you just put it into that spark plug and press it down with some pliers, and you can set a gap for that spark plug. So, you know, let's take the most primitive example possible, which is my Lambretta, right? Has the ignition is... contact breaker points. People say points. This is contact breaker points because your stator's moving around. It's generally just making electricity, whether it's 6 volt, 12 volt, whatever, right? It's making electricity. Something is spinning around. There's ways this happens, but at a certain point, these two metal contacts come apart. And you think you're used to, like, things turning on when wires touch each other, right? Like a light switch or something. Contact breaker points do a different thing. The points come across, come apart from each other, and all of a sudden the power that your stator's making loses ground. And there's a huge spike in voltage, and that electricity tries to find a ground. Because, and this is important to explain. So basically the end of that line where the electricity goes ends, you know, there's condensers, there's the fucking, there's the coils, there's all kinds of things that might be, there's the voltage regulator, there's all kinds of things in the way. But that line, right, points come apart, electricity is looking for a place to go, and the end of that line is the spark plug. That's all you need to understand, right? There's plenty of different ways this is set up, but at its very core, that's what you need to know. Well, really the end of the line is the very tip of the spark plug, because the It's the smaller bits on the at the end of your spark plug is essentially the ground, right? That's where the electricity is trying to get to. And in order to get there, it jumps from the tip of the spark plug to the center of the spark plug. And this is important to know because that very center bit of the spark plug is separated from the rest of the spark plug. Otherwise, it wouldn't be a ground that the electricity is looking for, right? So the next part of the spark plug, which is the part that very few people ever fucking talk about, is conductive qualities of the spark plug. The center bit is insulated from the rest of the spark plug, right? So things which are conductive conduct electricity and heat, and things which are non-conductive are... It's not like they won't move any electricity or heat, but are much, much more resistant to it, right? You can take the most non-conductive material you got. You put it on the surface of the sun. Guess what? Heat's going to go through it, right? So, depending on the tune of your engine, right? Spark plugs are set up to handle that. So the amount of electricity moving through and the kind of spark that you're getting is kind of really more has to do with the rest of your motorcycle. What condensers, what regulator, all that kind of
right.
shit.
So the internal resistance of the spark plug is also a specific feature that has to be tuned.
Right. So your engine, depending on the size, depending on the RPM range, depending on a lot of things, depending on the fuel for the engine, is going to work within a certain temperature range. Now, if it's an untuned engine, so it's working at a lower temperature range, you want the tip of that spark plug, the two tips, the cathode and anode, right, to be a certain temperature to allow the fuel that the spark plug's basically bathed in to burn all of that off. So it's not too hot where the plug essentially burns itself, and it's not too low where you get left unburnt fuel on the end of the plug and then it sort of like cakes up with carbon or whatever, or in some cases just straight up oil. Now,
this is also a good thing to note about how incredibly difficult it is to actually burn fuel, that the actual ignition source of the gasoline can get fouled and stop functioning because it gets too much fuel on it.
Yeah, I'm tired of everyone acting like the entire world is going to explode every time there's just gasoline somewhere.
Or somebody smoking within 50 feet of a pump.
I know, like, yeah. It's really not that big a
deal.
I
mean, maybe don't lean and, like, peer into your gas cap with a lit cigarette. But, like...
Yeah.
Can we have our phones out without somebody giving you a weird look? Like, it's...
I honestly believe it's probably perfectly safe to smoke cigarettes at the pump. But whatever. Cigarettes do not burn nearly as hot as you think they do.
I mean, I'm still going to say, like, walk 10 feet away, but, like, let's
yeah,
not...
Yeah, well, first of all, if you're smoking a cigarette, you want to enjoy the cigarette. You're going to get judged so much by smoking it anyway. At least find a relaxing setting for it, right? A pump is just, that's like, it's like talking on the phone while you're eating cake. You're not going to enjoy the cake, right? So don't smoke at the pump, just simply on the fact that it's a waste of a cigarette. But, you know, am I wrong?
No. So, but maybe, can we all agree that, like, we've gotten a little too, I mean, yes, there are going to be idiots who go way too far and do incredibly stupid things, but I think we all need to chill out a little bit around gas pumps.
Yeah, it's not nearly the, yeah. So, right. So where was I? Right. So the conductive quality of the thread that comes around where on the spark plug, right? That is designed also to move heat away from the tip of the spark plug at a certain rate to keep the plug within a certain temperature range that's in line with the temperature inside your engine. So if it's a very low-tuned engine, the spark plug wants to retain more heat in order to keep the tip at a certain temperature that you get a correct burn and you don't foul the plug. If it's a very high-tuned engine that's producing a lot of heat, you know, a race engine or whatever, then you want a spark plug that's actually moving heat away faster to help cool down the plug so you don't burn the plug. So it's very important that you really actually do select the correct spark plug, because even if it works for a short amount of time, if it's not the right plug, it's going to quit out on you and you're going to foul it up and whatever. Now, the world of two-stroke scooters knows this very well, because the specific kind of spark plug that most of these old two-stroke scooters need is very hard to find in the United States because almost nobody uses them. So auto parts stores have to order them specially. And when I've gotten these correct spark plugs in, it's either taken so long to get them in the mail that I forgot I ordered them by the time they show up, or O'Reilly or Advance gets them in and the person at the counter is like, why do you even need these? And every one that runs an old two-stroke kind of knows this life of carrying extra spark plugs because they can get fouled easily. Because even if you do have the right plug, the odds that you're consistently running it in such a way that it's optimized for that plug are still... So, like, if you're using the wrong plug in your old two-stroke, you are shit out of luck. It's just not going to run right for more than half an hour. But even if you are using the right plug, you might still foul those plugs up. So you got to be carrying extra plugs with you. And this is why you'll see, like, a lot of old two-strokes that are running have two spark plugs in them, but only one plug is hooked up.
Well, it's like the Greaves that Dad has actually has two threaded inserts, like, next to the headlight.
That's what I'm talking about, yeah.
That holds two extra spark plugs.
Yeah. So I could get deeper into why you need the correct spark plug, but it really comes into, you know, like, is it meant for 6 volt or 12 volt? Is it meant for a certain temperature range? Is it the right size? Where is it placed? What kind of compression is the engine? There's a lot of different factors. And it turns out, really, the heroes of the spark plug story are NGK. And it turns out in the 30s in Japan, NGK were pioneers and figured a lot of this fucking shit out. So basically, Champion and NGK, like, to this day are still the badasses in spark plugs for very good reason. But NGK especially, like, reading into some of the history of NGK, could be its own episode. The NGK spark plugs, kind of looking like my favorite brand of spark plugs right now from what I've been reading up on them. Pretty cool shit. Just taking into account different things that engine builders were doing and providing solutions for that just within the spark plug itself. They are at the same time very simple and ridiculously tuned to their specific job. And I kind of knew this, but I didn't know as many of the specifics of it. I was like, well, you know, right size spark plug, whatever. Maybe your engine won't be, like, optimized, but it's going to run. And it turns out, like, oh, yeah. Throughout my life, I've seen these problems and not known exactly what was causing it. I mean, I've known how to read a spark plug, but now knowing more about how the spark plug is constructed
and why it's constructed in those ways and what the difference in materials is. Yeah, I'm basically never going to look at a vehicle again without doing a lot of inspecting what spark plug is in it before I do anything else now. Because the number of four strokes are definitely more forgiving for putting the wrong spark plug in than two strokes, but it's still a concern no matter what you're running.
Yeah, but also most of the four-stroke vehicles we've had have been bikes with readily accessible spark plugs. So you just search for the model of spark plug that's in the manual and it just works because it's available.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think definitely for older motors, especially for two-stroke motors, it's worth looking up and getting, not just looking on a forum and saying, oh, these ones will work. It's what is the correct spark plug and being very particular about that.
Yeah. And, you know, they make these spark plugs. What got me too was, okay, well, you would think, okay, this is the spark plug for this bike. But because I've talked about how I'm going to be tuning this Lambretta up at some point, it's like, oh, well, at what point do I stay with this spark plug and then move to the next one, right? How, you know, I got to figure out, well, when I take this from a 125 to a 185 and take it from like, and I double the horsepower from like 5.5 to 10.5, is how far is that heat range going to move? And am I going to be on the border of, you know, kind of like you change your carburetor jetting, right? And you move between a few things and eventually you find the sweet spot. Am I going to have to try to move between the B7 ES and B8 ES plugs and be like, which one's running better in this right now? Right? Is there even a little bit of spark plug tuning that I'm going to have to do? I think I'm still going to be closer to the B7 because the B7 was what a lot of the old 200cc motors were running at, which is like very close to the range I'm going to be running in.
But is that still also going to be based on where the thread stops in the head?
That's true, because I'll be using completely different heads. I need to make sure. But I think most of these kits that they're selling for these bikes now take that into account, that they're just, they kind of go between the NGK B7 and B8 plugs. So it shouldn't matter because they're both the same length. What's different about those two plugs is the quality and how they move heat from the end of the plug is the big difference. And that's why those B8s that are readily available were fouling so quickly on like Claire's low tuned P125.
Right.
The plug was just too cold to effectively, you know, burn all the gas. And that's why it was fouling plugs like crazy. So then getting the B7, which is a hotter plug, you would think, oh, the hotter engine needs the hotter plug. Mm-mm, it's backwards. So I got the pain in the ass to get B7 plugs, which thank God I bought too many of, because when I learned I had the wrong plug in the Lambretta, I was like, oh, I happen to have a few spares of this correct plug. I was like the only person for hundreds of miles around that had the right plug. So, I don't know, just an interesting thing to look at. If you've replaced your spark plugs and you just kind of replaced them with, well, whatever, this seems to work. If you're having anything but perfect running, take a little bit of a look at that. And if you've modified your engine in any way, take a look at what plug you're running. Because, yeah, maybe it just works, but does it work super well over 50 to 400 miles of usage? Or did something weird happen? You know, you took the plug out and it was wet or built up with soot or something, because you might not be using the right plug. And what's happy days about using the wrong spark plug is it's way easier to change than a carburetor jet. It's right there. You just unscrew it and put a different one in. hey, there you go. I could also, if I wanted to, get into the fact that if you're using the wrong spark plug and it's not burning all of your fuel as well because it's not the right temperature, that could be doing some things like cause, because you're not burning all of the fuel, throwing off the whole temperature of your bike, and that could be fucking with how the fuel, like what timing you're using can come into play there. And your whole engine could be running way too hot. There's a lot of things. There's pre-ignition issues that are possible. There's a lot of stuff. It turns out you can get a PhD in how your fucking spark plug is affecting your overall setup. And you know, some people use the wrong spark plug stubbornly and advance or retard their timing so much to compensate for it is another little weird thing that I found. And then this leads to it. If you thought debates over what kind of oil you're running were an embarrassing old man yelling at clouds type of argument that was happening on forums, wait till you discover the world of old men arguing over advanced timing degrees for leaded versus unleaded fuel. Holy shit. This is a level of old mandom you aren't fucking ready for. This goes deep. That people are accusing other people of outright not knowing what they're talking about. People are accusing other people of the internet's most deadly sin, not doing your research. Holy crap. Okay, I have to stop now before I start going into what these old guys are fucking talking about with advanced degree time. Like, shit. So anyway, do we have anything else we want to bring up on this episode? We're at 2 hours now, which is a pretty good time.
I think we're good for this one.
You think we're good? Okay, so next week is Circuit of the Americas. So we'll probably have a good full like 10 days before the next episode. So we're going to want to make sure that we watch Circuit of the Americas and really take it in. We're going to hopefully have some sort of ride report, because we need to get everybody out on their bikes for a big group ride pretty soon here.
We do.
And not only that, I think next weekend Dr. Mike is coming up. So we need to see if, because he's moving basically across the street from me. So we need to see if we can get Laura to ride some of the boxes up and him bring a motorcycle and leave it with us. So he's got a bike to, whether it's the scooter or the Enfield or the Buell or the Kawasaki, whatever, something. So we should be able to get some sort of group ride happening next weekend or afterwards. And anything else that we know for certain we'll be talking about next week, just to tease it to people? I can't think of anything. Whatever. That's going to be good enough.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Lastly, the last time I said it, we got a couple really great ratings and reviews from listeners. So I'm going to say again, hey, if you made it this far, you really have no excuse but to leave a 5-star rating and review. We gave you advice on how not to sell things on Craigslist. We taught you more about spark plugs. We coached you up on lane splitting. I mean, what more do you want? What possible other value could you have gotten out of a free motorcycle podcast this week? So let's get that 5-star rating review up there so we can bump our numbers a little bit. And with that, I think we can say stay safe, stay tuned, and keep fighting or fucking the dragon. Yeah, let's do it.
And I don't want to die. I just want to ride on my motorcycle.